This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The guy who basically invented card counting to beat the house in blackjack, Ed Thorpe, took his math skills to Wall Street in the 1960s, started a hedge fund, and paved the way for a new breed of mathematical traders who became known as quants. The quants were the math whizzes who, with the help of computers, came up with the complex formulas for hedge fund investments and for designing complex investment vehicles like mortgage derivatives and credit default swaps, things that were behind the market collapse of 2008. My guest Ed Thorpe is one of the people profiled in the new book The Quants, How a New Breed of Math Whizzes Conquered Wall Street and Nearly Destroyed It. Later, we'll meet the author Scott Patterson. He's a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Scott Patterson, Ed Thorpe, welcome to Fresh Air. Ed, let's start with your story, since you're considered the father of the quants, like one of the first quants. And with you, it all started with mathematical formulas you came up with for counting cards in blackjack in casinos. So let's go back to the casino days and start there. First of all, why did you even want to do it? Why did you want to come up with a mathematical formula for dealing with roulette tables and blackjack?
Well, as a mathematician, I had been told that there were certain things that were impossible to do, and one of them was to beat gambling games with any kinds of mathematical methods. And when I happened to accidentally come across a statistics paper which told how to play blackjack rather well, but not able to beat it, I got intrigued. And after I worked on it for a while, I saw that there was, in fact, a way that was almost certain, in my opinion, to beat it. So then when I went to MIT, I used the new big computers that were just then coming available to make calculations. And from those, I was able to devise the first card counting systems, take them out to the casinos, use them, and find they worked. So that got me interested in applying mathematics to real-world problems, and particular ones that involved ideas from gambling and from ideas for investing.
Did you like gambling as much as you liked math?
No. The fun of gambling for me was going out and seeing a mathematical system that I'd thought up actually work and generate real profits in the real world instead of just being something that was an abstract collection of symbols on a piece of paper.
Okay, so getting back to blackjack, which is a game where you have to reach 21, and if you go over 21, you lose, and the one who comes closest to 21 wins. What kind of cards did you have to count to have the edge over the house in a casino?
What I found was that each card could be assigned a weight, basically a number from 1 to 11, positive or negative, and with those weights, you counted cards as they fell, and you could use the total count that you had so far to figure out how good or bad the deck was for you. And I found you could greatly simplify this. You could, for instance, just take cards that were small, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and call them plus 1 when they fell. And you could take big cards like tens and aces and call them minus 1 when they fell. Start with zero and just sort of keep track of the total count, and that would give you a very good indication of whether the deck was good for you or bad for you. When the count was plus, you'd bet bigger, and when the count was negative, you'd bet as little as you could to just keep your seat.
So when you were counting cards, could you keep all this in your head, or did you have like a little hidden computer?
No, I actually sat down for a summer and had my wife and brother deal me cards and blow smoke at me and try to distract me, so I got very comfortable doing it, and I could just almost do it in my sleep. It just became automatic.
So when you decided to try this out, to try your card counting system at casinos, you needed some money, somebody to help bankroll you, and the person you found named Manny Kimmel. Scott Patterson, in his book, describes him as a racketeer with his fingers in everything from numbers games in Newark to East Coast horse tracks. So did you know he was connected to organized crime when he bankrolled you?
No, I discovered all this 30 years later. What happened was I gave a paper to the American Mathematical Society in Washington, D.C., and there was a huge burst of interest. National newspaper stories and so on, and many people contacted me, and he wanted to put up $100,000 to bankroll a test of my system in the casinos in Nevada. And there'd been a lot of ridicule from casinos and from the newspaper op-ed page in the Washington Post. And so I decided that the best thing to do was to prove that it actually worked. If I said it worked and never proved it, how did I know for sure?
So how did you meet Kimmel in the first place?
He called me and kept pestering me and wanting to get together for a meeting. And then I finally got together with him. And when I told him how the system worked, he got very excited. And I used to fly down to New York and play blackjack every Wednesday with him to prove to him that I really could count and that the system actually transferred money from his side of the table to mine at a pretty good clip. So after a few weeks of this, he was ready, and we went out to Reno and Stateline, Nevada.
So did you do the playing yourself, or did you communicate signals to them when they played? How did it work?
I did the playing, but Kimmel would sit down next to me sometimes and want me to tell him how to play his hands too. And I would have preferred it if he had just let me be, because one night when we were winning a rather large amount of money, he wouldn't quit when I got tired and felt that I had to quit. So he lost some of the money back. And even so, the test was very successful. We more than doubled our $10,000 bankroll, which was what I thought would happen from theory. And so everything worked out the way it was supposed to.
Now, as you started doing this more and more in the casinos, did the casino people get onto you? Did they realize that you were counting cards, that you had a method that they would prefer you did not use?
When I first started to play, they didn't understand what was happening.
Because no one was counting cards yet, right? I mean, you kind of invented that.
There have been a few people a decade before who realized that when you got down to the very end of the deck, if it was mostly tens and aces, then you could take a whole lot of hands so that your first card would be a 10 or ace and bet a whole lot of money on those hands. So there were people who were starting to do that. But the general idea of card counting was unknown at that time. So, yes, my book, Beat the Dealer, was the and the paper that I published before that was the first revelation of that to everybody.
So before you wrote your book and revealed some of your secrets, were the dealers mystified that you were beating the house so often?
Yes, and they came up with a lot of strange theories. In one case, for example, they began to shuffle all the time because they thought that I was doing something to the cards and knew what they were. And I said, why are you doing this? And they said, well, we think that you can memorize every single card in the deck and know where it is. So I said, that doesn't make any sense to me. And so the pit boss walked up, and I said to the pit boss, can you memorize every single card in the deck and then tell me the order of the cards? And he said, yes. So I said, I don't believe you. I've got $5. I've got $5 here which says you can't do it. And he didn't answer. So I said, I've got $100 which says you can't do it. No answer. I said, I've got $500 which says you can't do it. No answer. So I think we've settled that.
So did anybody ever get on to you and throw you out?
Yes, they began to tell me they didn't want my business there anymore, and they didn't want any of my friends coming either. But they didn't know why. They just knew that it was bad news.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think it was 1961 that you started successfully counting cards in blackjack.
Yes.
At casinos. And then in 62, you published your book about card.
Yes.
Counting. So you basically outed yourself.
Well, actually, my idea wasn't to make money. It was to show that I had an idea that worked. And I figured that between the time I started doing it and the time that I outed myself, that I'd be able to make as much money as I needed for our rather modest needs as a little family. I was simply teaching in a university, and university professors aren't used to having a lot of money. They can live rather frugally.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Ed Thorp and Scott Patterson. And Ed Thorp is a math genius who got his start kind of counting cards at casinos and then went on to become a quant, one of the math geniuses who figured out statistical ways of investing. And Scott Patterson has written a new book called The Quants, How a New Breed of Math Whizzes Conquered Wall Street and Nearly Destroyed It. And Ed Thorpe is one of the people who figures prominently in the book. Scott, I guess I'll ask you first, since you wrote the book, The Quants. What is a quant?
A quant is somebody who uses mathematics and computers to essentially predict the future of the market. Kind of like a weatherman uses computers and models to predict what the weather is going to be tomorrow or next week. A quant on Wall Street is using very similar techniques to predict where a stock is going to go, where all sorts of other securities are going to go. They do a lot of other things too, but essentially it comes down to using math and computers to predict the future.
So what are some of the major changes that the entrance of quants onto the Wall Street scene made on Wall Street?
Well, the quants really started rising in the 60s. I think Ed Thorpe was probably one of the first, if not the first quant. But they really took off in the 70s with the introduction of a formula called the Black-Scholes option pricing formula. And this was a mathematical model that was used to price options on stocks. And it became very, very popular. It was applied to all sorts of other securities across Wall Street. And as more and more people started using this formula, which was coded into computers, it became a very dominant force on Wall Street. And the guys using this formula started pushing aside the old school traders, the guys who sort of traded by the gut and, use their intuition to figure out where the market was going to go. And, in the 70s and 80s, more and more of these guys were showing up on the trading floors in Wall Street, starting up hedge funds. And because they were able to predict the future of securities more accurately, they were making more money than the other guys.
Ed Thorpe, why did you want to take your math skills to Wall Street after kind of conquering the casinos?
Well, I thought that the ideas I developed in card counting and roulette and the analysis of other gambling games would carry over in large part to the securities markets. And the biggest casino in the world appeared to me to be Wall Street. So I thought it would be intriguing to try these things out there and see what happened. And coincidentally, I'd come across an idea about warrant hedging that I'd thought up after reading some literature on the market. When I came out here to University of California, Irvine, where I happen to be sitting right now talking as a founding faculty member in 1965, I ran into another faculty member there named Sheen Kasouf, an economist. And he'd been thinking along the same lines, and he'd actually been doing some investing in these warrant hedges that made sense to me. So we teamed up and worked on our ideas and improved them and wrote a book called Beat the Market. And then I went on to use the ideas in that book and some further ideas to create a hedge fund, the first market-neutral hedge fund that was ever created.
What's a market-neutral hedge fund?
It's one which takes positions that will hopefully make you money no matter which way the market goes. So the market risk has been eliminated by hedging, by having both long positions on one side and short positions on the other. So if the market goes up, your long positions will make extra money to pay off the losses that your short positions will lose. And if you've got the right kind of a hedge, when the price errors in the securities disappear, some money will come out, some extra money.
And Scott Patterson, what was the impact on this hedge fund that Ed Thorpe created on the market and the way the market thought? Did this lead to a lot of other similar hedge funds?
Absolutely. Ed's hedge fund, which he founded in 1969, had a tremendous impact on Wall Street. Not immediate, because I think in the beginning most people didn't really understand what he was doing. He was fairly small for a while, but as more and more people started seeing the success of his hedge fund, Princeton Newport Partners, they started using similar strategies. If you think about this idea that Ed came up with of a market-neutral hedge fund, it was a revolutionary idea. It's a way of betting money on Wall Street that can reap you huge profits no matter which direction the market is going. And this really became the core idea of what the hedge fund industry became. Ed's fund never lost money in a calendar year. And so he really did know what he was doing. And I think that over the years, a lot of the lessons that he tried to teach people got lost. And the bets that the hedge funds started making became bigger, wilder, and more reckless. And the hedging that Ed came up with, the hedging strategies, they sort of gotten left by the wayside.
So what was the first sign, Scott Patterson, that the quants were actually making some big mistakes that were creating turbulence in the market?
I think probably the first time that people started realizing that something was amiss was Black Monday in October 1987. A quantitative methodology called portfolio insurance, which was a method based on option pricing formulas to hedge giant portfolios of stocks. And a huge amount of money had been put into these portfolio insurance contracts. And it was a quantitative formula. And on Black Monday, they created a cascade effect because as the market started to fall, more people started selling stocks to balance out the portfolio insurance contracts, and it created a feedback loop.
So, Scott Patterson, what were the lessons learned on Wall Street by the quants after Black Monday in 1987?
That's a good question. If you look at what Ed was doing, Ed was using similar models to those that led to the blow up on Black Monday. The difference between what he was doing and what a lot of practitioners on Wall Street were doing is that Ed actually has a common sense feel for the market, and he's also highly risk averse. He's always thinking about big disasters that could happen. You know, I've talked to him about things he thinks about. He worries about, you know, a nuclear bomb hitting New York City or some horrible event happening in Tokyo or all sorts of scenarios that could throw his models off kilter. And he adjusts for that. The lessons that Wall Street should have learned decades ago in 1987 is that the models don't incorporate these giant moves, and they also don't take into effect the fact that they change the market. When you have billions of dollars flowing into these models, everybody's doing the same thing. If it starts to unravel, you have this giant feedback loop, and we've seen it over and over again. And so did they learn anything? I think maybe they did for a while, but they forgot it pretty quickly.
Let's jump ahead to the mortgage meltdown crisis of 2008 and the collapse of the stock market. Ed, as one of the first quants, what role do you see the quants as having played in the development of the credit default swaps and the securitized mortgages that got us into so much trouble in 2008 that caused the collapse of the housing market and the stock market?
I think that the quants are actually surprisingly fairly far down the food chain here. The sell side on Wall Street is always wanting to invent new products that sound good, and they go out and make a lot of money selling them. And the quants are their experts who craft these products. The quants on Wall Street now, in large part, don't have market sense, and they don't have a long history of experience with what's wrong with models. They simply take the math, they themselves are wowed by it, and they build a machine which, in their imaginary world, must work just fine and must be safe and sound. But in fact, with the securitized pools that were put together to underlie these things, terrible unsound mortgages were put into the pools. And that's not directly the fault of the quants, except that the quants should, if they were poking around and curious, have known how unsound these things were. It's more the fault of the sell side, who didn't care what was in there and figured they would sell it off and they wouldn't be caught holding the bag, and of the regulators in government who simply looked the other way.
So, Ed Thorpe, as a quant, did you participate in the creation of any of these exotic vehicles that got us into trouble through the securitized mortgages and the credit default swaps and all the stuff that led to the housing bubble and bust and the stock market collapse?
Actually, no. In 1985, when these first mortgage pools were being put together, I analyzed them as possible investments for our hedge fund. And there were two things that I found unanalyzable. The first one was to determine the quality of the mortgages in the pools. And that would require going out and looking at hundreds or thousands of different houses and trying to mortgage documents to try to figure out what was going on. That was so costly and time-consuming as to be unfeasible. Another thing that was important was how fast investors would prepay. And that was unpredictable. It depended upon what the future of interest rates was. If interest rates went way down, they'd prepay, and they'd refinance with a new lender at a lower rate. And if interest rates went way up, they'd hang on to their low-rate mortgages, and they would not prepay. And this was prepayment rate was very important in how much these securities were worth. And the last thing was the default rate. That's where you had to go out and check all the contracts and do a lot of analysis. You couldn't predict the default rate even then because that depended on general economic conditions. If the default rate in the 1930s was far different than the default rate in the 1920s, for example, and the same thing in the 60s versus the 70s. So these were things that could not be quantified or analyzed, and yet they were pretending that you could. So we stayed away from all those.
So, Ed Thorpe, were you invested in the market a lot, either personally or through your own hedge fund, in 2008 during the stock market collapse?
Yes. At 2008, unfortunately, I didn't have any place to hide. I did not have a hedge fund then, so I wasn't managing more than a very small part of my own money. The small part I managed did fine. It made about 18% that year, but most of the money I had was in other things. Other people's hedge funds and so on. I was trying to retire and live the good life.
So you lost a lot of money with the money you had invested in other people's hedge funds?
A significant amount. We've mostly recovered, but not quite all of it.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the ways that you feel the mathematical models that you helped create didn't foresee the housing bubble and therefore the housing collapse?
Well, the problem is that the people using these methods and models didn't use them correctly. They thought they applied to things they didn't apply to. It would be as though I were talking about gambling odds and somebody were to ask me, what's the chance of a plague of locusts? Or, you know, what's the chance that seas will run red with blood? I was actually asked that once in a murder trial. And my answer was, those are one-time events. They're out of the collection of assumptions you make when you make probability estimates. And so probability estimates have nothing to say about events like this. You can't stipulate a probability that one of these things will happen. And these huge tail events, way out on the tails of a probability distribution, come for reasons that are kind of outside the assumptions and the experience of the models.
Ed Thorpe, as far as you can tell now, how are quants being used on Wall Street? Are these mathematical models relied on as heavily now after the stock market collapse as they were before?
My impression is pretty much. There's a giant industry now. Many thousands of people who otherwise would have gone into engineering and science have gone over to Wall Street to work on these things because the pay is better and it's fun. And they're still there. They have a vested interest in staying there. And I think people, a lot of people think that we're just going to go back to business as usual in this country, that this is all going to blow over and we're not going to have any significant increase in regulation. We're not going to have any significant listing of off-the-book derivatives on exchanges like the commodity futures exchanges, and that we'll set ourselves up for another big fall. That's what I'm afraid will happen.
So how's that affecting how much you want to have invested in the market?
Well, it's tough. The question is, you know, where do you go? We only have one world we live in. If they had a market on Mars, I might think about going there. But I think it's going to be very difficult. And I personally find it hard to guess exactly when some bad thing will happen and how long it will take and what will trigger it, just like in this last crash. You know something bad's going to happen. You just don't know when or how.
And Scott Patterson, author of the book The Quants, what's your impression of the role quants are playing now on Wall Street?
Well, to me, it looks like they're taking off as fast as they can, looking for new places to invest. And one area that you see the quants really taking off is in the world of high-frequency trading, which is super fast trading using supercomputers. It's really having a massive impact on the stock market and raising a lot of concerns with regulators. These high-frequency traders can send buy and sell orders to stock exchanges at rates that would make your head spin, thousands of orders per second. And there are some concerns that the orders are flying so fast that they could trigger some kind of destabilizing sell-off on the market. It's actually very worrisome. I share Ed's concerns that the lessons haven't been learned, that the rewards on Wall Street are so phenomenal that if you're allowed to bet enough money over, say, a period of a year or so, you could be set for life. And if you lose the money, then it's not your problem; it's the taxpayer's problem. And that's a huge systemic issue that we have that everybody today is trying to come to grips with.
Now, just one more thing, Ed Thorp. I read about you that you have signed up to have your body cryogenically frozen when you die, in the hopes that science will have reached the point eventually that you can be unfrozen and brought back to life. Knowing you, as I've come to know you during the course of this interview, I assume you've played the odds and figured out what the odds are that you will be brought back to life. So what are the odds?
I would say that the longer I live, the further along science will be, so the odds get higher and higher. But I'd say right now, 2%.
That's pretty low, isn't it?
I think so, but it's better than zero.
Mm-hmm. What are the odds you think you'll be happy if the 2% turns out to be true and you're brought back to life?
Maybe 50-50. Depends on how good a job they do and what the world's like then.
Precisely.
Many, uncertainties.
Okay. I want to thank you both, Scott Patterson, Ed Thorp. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Terry.
Scott Patterson is the author of the new book, The Quants, How a New Breed of Math Whizzes Conquered Wall Street and Nearly Destroyed It. Ed Thorp was one of the first quants and is profiled in the book. The new book, Get Me Out, is a history of childbirth. It's about the advice women have been given about pregnancy and birth, why so many women died during or after birth before modern medicine, how modern medicine changed the experience of childbirth, and the changing views of feminists regarding the pros and cons of painkillers. My guest is the author of Get Me Out, Randi Epstein. She's a medical journalist. Randi Hutter Epstein, welcome to Fresh Air. I think we forget how dangerous childbirth used to be. Not that it still doesn't have its dangers, but the mortality rate for mothers and children was so much higher in the past. What were some of the most common problems for women giving birth?
The big problems were hemorrhaging, bleeding to death, and childbed fever, of course, was the huge problem. Now, if you go back and look at the statistics, which other historians have done, statistically, it was not this huge epidemic of childbed fever.
Explain what childbed fever is.
Okay, childbed fever. We didn't know. We named childbed fever for women years ago who would give birth, spark a fever in the next couple days. Some would recover, but others would die, and no one knew what was happening. So that's why they just named it childbed fever. We didn't know what it was. Today, we now look back, or we figured it out along the way when we discovered germs, that a lot of these women were infected with germs. There was, and a lot of the cause was from doctors who might have done an autopsy or delivered someone else's baby. They were rushed. Then they came and delivered yours. They weren't washing their hands. So they were just sort of passing things from one woman to another. And remember, this is before we knew about germs and the germ theory. So the few doctors that started saying, shouldn't we wash up in between patients? They were kind of seen as a little kooky.
In writing about the history of childbirth, you write about how forceps changed childbirth, both for the person delivering the baby and for the woman having the baby. Forceps were invented by a family that kept these instruments secret from the rest of the medical world. Tell us what you know of the story of how the forceps were invented.
Sure. I mean, there were all these wacky forceps that date back years and years ago, generations, hundreds of years ago. Most of those forceps really ripped the baby, didn't work so well. What we think are sort of the first of modern forceps that were safe for both the mother and the baby were invented by this family called the Chamberlains, who go back to the late 1500s, and they passed on their secret forceps from son to son to son, who all became male midwives. Their popularity really grew in the 1800s, although they had been doing this for years. There weren't a lot of men in the business for the first generations of the Chamberlain family. One of the things I think that a lot of people feel about the Chamberlains is, what a bunch of jerks. I mean, they had what supposedly was saving lives of babies and women, and they didn't share their secret with anyone, with their colleagues. But actually, that was standard practice in those days. Doctors were highly competitive. So if you had something that worked, you kept it to market your own business. And that's exactly what the Chamberlains did. And they were not well-liked by their colleagues. But they became, by the 1800s, the doctors who rich, wealthy women would seek out if they decided to choose the route of male midwife.
And where were the Chamberlains? Were they in England, the United States?
They were in England. They were originally from France, but they came over to England, and that's where they set up shop in England.
So when forceps really started to catch on to people beyond the Chamberlain family, you say that the doctors who were delivering with forceps, because of the kind of cultural taboos of the era, couldn't really see what they were doing. Would you describe the kind of sheet that would separate the woman and the doctor and what that was like?
Sure. Now, this has to do with male doctors, whether or not they used forceps. There were other forceps starting to be invented. But when women started to think, gosh, I'll get a man in the room because he seems so professional, or for one reason or another, her husband thought it was more professional to have a medically trained person in the room, we still could not fathom that this male doctor would see you naked. So what they would do is cover the woman with a sheet. And basically, it was set up so it looked like she had a tent over her. So the doctor really couldn't see what he was doing. And I think the scariest was those with a forceps in their hands. And they would put their hands under the sheet and deliver the baby without seeing anything. And the oddest part of all of this is that part of medical training in some of the medical schools in America and in England and in France required young apprentices to watch a baby being born. So basically what these medical students did is they would walk into a birthing room and they would watch their mentor sticking his hands under sheets and pulling a baby out. But I'm not sure how much they learned from that experience.
Now you write in your book that after forceps started catching on, that other doctors and inventors came up with, you know, odd tools and gadgets. You know where this is going to help women deliver. And the most bizarre one that you mentioned, and you have an illustration of it, is do-it-yourself forceps.
That was great. It didn't catch on. I do say it didn't catch on, but it is there. I mean, one of the things I do have to say before I get to this do-it-yourself forcep is all these books that I looked at, I can't judge, except for this, that said it didn't last. It's hard to judge what advice women listen to and what, you know, what was in the books that we really, that women took to heart, because there's books now that we just sort of ignore. But these do-it-yourself forceps, I think that it was partly done because, again, we talked about that immorality of doctors just getting in there and sticking their hands in a woman. And I think that people thought, well, gosh, with forceps, maybe we could make this more culturally acceptable to keep these male doctors farther away from this naked woman. So they did come up with these contraptions that all had your basic forceps, which sort of look like these two big ladles attached together. And then some of them had all these strings and pulleys attached so that the doctors could be far away, sort of like when you see workmen with scaffolding and all those poles outside a building and somehow get the baby out. But the Italian one where I, you know, it's just, it's hard to explain without the picture, but it's a forcep and all these strings that tie it around a bedpost. So apparently a woman can just keep pulling and then the baby will shoot out. And I'm not sure who catches it on the other end.
One of the threads in your book is how women have dealt with the pain of childbirth and how cultures have dealt with it. Of course, you say this all goes back to Eve in the Old Testament. What was Eve's contribution to pain in childbirth?
Well, I blame her for starting it all. I mean, you know, she ate the apple, she was punished, and then they said, now birth will be painful. So she started it. Whether we believe the story or not, I mean, that's sort of in our culture. And since then, we've grappled with, is pain a good thing or a bad thing? So for years, it was thought of as sort of a hazing process, that it was part of your heavenly duty to give birth through pain, to survive it, and then you could become a mother. So a lot of the things that were done to maybe try to alleviate the pain were considered heresy in a way. And it wasn't until we say that Queen Victoria gave birth using ether that some other women said, hey, well, the queen did it. It's got to be good enough for us. So she is thought of as giving the green light to drugs for delivery. And in terms of culture you asked me about, I still think that how we use pain medication is a cultural response. At the turn of the century or in the 1910s, a group of women here, in New York actually, heard about a new technique in Germany that was called twilight sleep. And basically you were knocked out during delivery. Interestingly, this became this feminist crusade. We deserve to be knocked out. We deserve not to have to remember anything about childbirth. And what I think is fascinating is, jump a few decades ahead to the 1970s, and feminists were saying, we deserve to be awake. We deserve to remember everything about our pregnancy. So to me, again, this has nothing to do with scientific evidence or improvements in medical technology. It's what women themselves wanted in the birth of their children.
Now, let's contrast the feminist movement that of the early 1900s that asked for painkillers during childbirth. Let's contrast that with the later 1900s and in the 60s and 70s when women started demanding to be awake during childbirth and to be more active participants in childbirth and endure the pain that came with that with the help of prepared techniques like breathing. So tell us how the Lamaze's technique of breathing during childbirth to help control pain and relax muscles. How did that get imported to the United States?
Well, that came over Well, it was really two things. That came over from someone called Grantley Dick Reed, who was a doctor. He never was board certified as an OBGYN, and he became this birthing guru. And there are women today who are very involved in natural childbirth who really look back on him as this wonderful doctor that was preaching natural childbirth while all the other doctors were saying, no, you know, let's use drugs, we're in charge. He really started talking about natural childbirth in the late 1940s. If you read what he was writing, he was saying things basically opposite what the doctors were saying, that modern women are too frail to give birth. He was sort of saying, you know, you're so neurotic. You are just too, and he used that word. He said, these women are too neurotic. They should be able to give birth. And it's the Christian way to give birth is through pain. So his message wasn't as 1970s as we'd like to think it was. That said, women did pick up on this anti-doctor sentiment that he had. And what I do think, both looking back at the turn of the century and looking back at the 1970s, the real issue isn't so much pain or no pain, drugs or no drugs. The real issue is doctor-patient relationships. And in both cases, you'll see that women were angry with their doctors, so they were demanding the opposite of what their doctors wanted to do. And I think that's what motivated some women, not all, but motivated. Yes, of course, in the 1970s, there were women that said, you know, we're worried about the drugs and we're worried about the side effects. But I also think there was an anger against authority then, too, the way there was the anger in the 1910s and 15s by some women against some doctors. So I think that propelled both movements.
What development do you think is most changing childbirth now?
I think, for better or for worse, all the assisted reproductive technology, and I'm not talking in vitro fertilization, I'm talking really a lot of the genetic diagnosis and looking at embryos and analyzing them before we transfer them into a woman. Of course, for better, it would be phenomenal to be able to say, look, I have this devastating genetic disease in my family. Please make sure the embryo does not have that disease. I think that's terrific. It would be great to break a cycle of a disease. But on the other hand, I think that so many people feel that they'll be able to choose the perfect baby. And one of the threads, I think, going through my book is that this search for perfection has been going on forever. You know, thousands of years ago, we thought if we have sex in a certain way or if we think happy thoughts, then we will have the perfect child. And now I think it's if we choose the right sperm from our Ivy League donor who is a musician and an athlete, and we choose the egg of this gorgeous Ivy League brilliant woman, then our child has to be perfect. And I think that that can lead to parents being let down by the end result.
Well, Randi Hutter Epstein, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Randi Hutter Epstein is the author of Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank.